Hello, podcast listeners, and welcome back to the Rational Faiths Podcast, the best podcast on the Blabbernacle. I am your host, Brian Dillman. And before we get into talking about the episode today, I want to remind all listeners about the fundraising project that we are undertaking in supporting another Liahona Children's Foundation stake for this next year. Again, last year we were successful in raising enough money to support a stake in Cambodia, and we're trying to repeat that effort. We went over our goal last year, so we've upped the stakes in trying to raise $10,000. We've put up an Indiegogo page to serve as our platform for the fundraising campaign, and there you can go to donate, and when you donate, you can pick a perk or a gift of works of art or different types of bonuses, if you will, from various LDS artists, authors, and business people in general. There's already been a fair amount of attention that makes me really excited. We have, as of the time that I'm recording this intro, $1,970 donated to the cause, which is approximately 20% of our goal. So please go over there and participate in the fundraising effort for this Christmas season. With that in hand, the topic today is another episode of the Human Mormon Mind series, and the focus is memory. This is a topic that has been incredibly fascinating to me. In the book, You Are Not So Smart, there's not a particular chapter dealing with memory directly, but there are several chapters that do discuss memory effects. And the ones that come to mind as I'm recalling this are the misinformation effect, which is chapter 32, chapter 40, which is attention, and chapter 44, which is consistency bias. After you listen to this podcast, if you look into those chapters, you'll find ways in which we alter our memories to fit with our current worldview. So with that in hand, let's jump right to our discussion. On this next installment of the Human Mormon Mind series, I have LaShawn Scholes and Misha McGriggs with us again. LaShawn and Misha, why don't you say hello?
Hello.
Hello.
And Misha, why don't you start first? You've been on a few times. Remind everyone who you are and what you've been up to in the Mormon world.
Sure. So I'm Misha McGriggs. I am a PhD candidate in counseling psychology at BYU. And I don't know what I've been up to. Probably shenanigans and trouble, but I'm glad to be back with you again, Brian.
Yeah. You've missed me since Kirtland, I think.
Yeah, I have.
That was a lot of fun.
It was. We had a good time.
LaShawn, why don't you, you were on, what discussion did we have last time? Was that the, that was anger.
Anger, indeed.
You were on the anger episode. That was our last one. So quickly remind everyone who you are, please.
I'm LaShawn Williams Schultz. I'm a candidate for my degree in doctorate in education. I'm a practicing mental health therapist and educator in higher ed.
Excellent. All right. Well, this topic has been on my mind for a long time. I think it's really fascinating and frustrating. And before we get to discussing it, let's cut to the mini lecture. I spent much of my time in high school playing guitar. And like other guitar nuts, I never learned to read music like those who went to proper training, studying piano or something else like that. I learned new songs through guitar tablature found online in various databases. I remember several times visualizing in my mind what I thought was a memory of previously seeing a link to tablature for a song that I wanted to learn on a website somewhere. When I went to look for the actual link that my brain was telling me existed, I could not find it. It simply wasn't there. This kind of experience is not unique only to me. Similarly, a memory researcher, Dr. Neisser, came to the realization that his own memory was as fragile as anyone else's. For years, he had said that he was listening to a baseball game on the radio when he had heard about the Pearl Harbor attack on December 7, 1941. Finally, he said, it dawned on him that he could not have been listening to a baseball game in December. They don't play baseball in the winter, you know. What he thought was a vivid memory was, at least in part, fabricated. This fabrication went on, unbeknownst to Neisser, and likely the same for any other human being experiencing such a false memory. Even more challenging than this is a deeply troubling story of Penny Ann Bernstein, who was out running along the Lake Michigan shoreline and was apprehended by an unknown man who forced her into a wooded area and sexually assaulted her on July 29, 1985, while on vacation. She recalls making an effort to etch her assailant's face in her mind, and later, when a lineup was produced, she confidently picked out Stephen Avery as the perpetrator, or who she thought was her attacker. Later, that is, 17 years later, DNA testing advocated through the Innocence Project, which first started in 1989, demonstrated that Stephen Avery, who had spent nearly two decades in prison, wasn't at the scene of the crime and did not commit that crime. It was a man named Gregory Allen. How does this happen? How do we confidently recall facts of traumatic events and yet be wrong when we feel that we can only be right? In order to answer that question, we need to have a short discussion of memory research. In 1977, Harvard researchers published an article about memory in the journal Cognition. In questioning individuals about the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, surely an emotionally arousing event that rocked the nation, the term flashbulb memories was coined. The questionnaires revealed that almost everyone can remember with an almost perceptual clarity where he was, when he heard, what he was doing at the time, who told him, what was the immediate aftermath, how he felt about it, and also one or more totally idiosyncratic and often trivial details of the event. While the memories of the murder were indeed vivid, the study was not designed to establish whether the memories were accurate. Later, Ulrich Neisser came along as a cognitive psychology researcher. When the Challenger space shuttle disastrously exploded, Neisser prepared a questionnaire for his freshman psychology students to fill out, including the details of their very new and disturbing memory of the shuttle explosion. They recorded where they were and how they learned of the event. Then, 3 years later, during their senior year, they were tracked down again and asked to recall the memory. When the old and new questionnaires were compared, the details were quite often off. One of them, who confidently remembered learning about the disaster from TV when an announcer broke in with the news, had in fact heard about it from fellow students in her religion class. Another, who was quite sure he had been at home breakfasting with his family, had in fact been on campus. A woman student gave a dramatic account of a girl running through the dorm screaming, "The space shuttle blew up!" In fact, she had heard about it from friends over lunch. Of course, not everyone was mistaken to this extent. Many reports were partially right and a few almost completely so. But the mean score on their 7-point accuracy scale was only 2.95, and a quarter of the subjects were at zero. Nevertheless, almost all of them were very sure they were right. Other researchers have conducted similar experiments following other emotionally arousing public events, such as the O.J. Simpson trial and the 9/11 attacks. In general, the findings show that over time, on average, the fidelity between reality and our memory of it reliably deteriorates. What authors, historians, and most people have known or assumed to be true is being fleshed out in detail through psychological, scientific inquiry, and that is that memories fade. In the most famous biography of Joseph Smith, No Man Knows My History, Fawn Brody wrote the following: "A man's memory is bound to be a distortion of his past, in accordance with his present interest, and the most faithful autobiography is likely to mirror less what a man was than what he has become." Brody's assessment is true. We recreate our memories to cohere with our present state. Though I think it would be a mistake to conclude that the distortions of memories arise from a conscious choice to wipe the slate clean and fabricate a more favorable history of ourselves. In fact, the research I have cited here suggests the opposite. That is, that when we recall false or flawed memories, we think of them and understand them to be true recollections dug out of our gray matter hard drive. In reality, we are reconstructing our memory constantly to fit into some narrative that makes sense of the world as we currently see it. The field of memory research is fascinating and troubling. For example, recently experimenters have successfully implanted false memories of violent episodes into subjects' brains, which the subjects accepted to be true accounts of their own lives, until they were debriefed later. It seems that in order to really have a memory that we can rely on, we need to record our life and have the recordings available and ready for later examination. Rather than committing to tediously documenting our lives, I think we just need to get used to the idea that our memories may very well be wrong and that to rely on them as depictions of reality is a mistake. Whether we like it or not, this is the state of human memory. All right, so I'm curious. I shared in the mini lecture just a benign example of misremembering my like some internet websites and things like that. Do either of you two have any moments where you realize that a memory that you thought was real was in fact false and had been fabricated in your mind or adjusted in your mind in some way?
Sure. So I think for me, one thing that in particular sticks out is this is this memory that I created, I guess I created, about September 11th. And for the longest time, when people would ask, you know, where were you on September 11th? And they would say, like, there's things you just don't forget. Like, your parents don't forget where they were when Kennedy got shot. And you won't forget where you were on 9/11. And I really bought into that. And I was like, yeah, like, anytime I could remember about where I was with 9/11, it was that I would say that it was on my way to school. And I was driving to school. Like, I was driving myself to school. And then one day I did the math. And I was like, that's impossible because I was 11 in 2001. So there's no way that I was driving to school.
Not legally, at least.
Yeah, not legally. And no one would have given me the keys at 11. And I wasn't that much of a rebel.
Interesting. So you're just some of those students in that NICER study about the Challenger explosion that remembered that event differently than...
That literally happened to me. And I, so what I believe happened was that there was probably a time that was an anniversary that some particular thing I was listening to on the radio is the memory that I was thinking of. And it was an anniversary of 9/11 as opposed to actually, 9/11 itself.
That makes sense.
So,
LaShawn, do you recall any false recollections?
Oh, dear. I think as a parent, anything that I am liable to remember is probably questionable just because so many things occur with parenting and then being married and having arguments with your spouse. There are a lot of fabricated memories that I think come into play there. Nothing necessarily comes into mind except for just... I think a re-understanding of a story that was really significant for me. My mother grew up in the segregated South, and she was the first one to integrate her high school. And I remember her telling me that story. And so it would give me this puffed chest feeling of, you know, my mother and, like, you know, this Ruby Bridges moment where she's integrating her high school. And it's not so much a false memory as it is a lack of understanding of what was really going on. My mother integrated her high school in 1968. And, you know, as I got older and learned that Brown versus Board of Education happened in 1954, I was like, Mom, you're a liar. Because I was really upset with her for saying that she was the first one to integrate her high school. Because in my naivete, I thought that as soon as a law was passed in 1954, everybody integrated. But when you grew up in the segregated South, you realize that a lot of the schools were not integrated until the federal government threatened again to do so by 1971, if all schools in the South were not integrated. So then it, of course, made sense that she integrated her schools in 1968 or 69, whenever that was. So I'd have to think about other times where maybe I've remembered something one way and then it's ended up being something else. One thing that comes to mind is the day of my wedding. I remember, I found out later, but I thought that I knew in advance that my wedding cake had actually been dropped the day they picked it up. And so they had to buy another one. And I never knew that they had done that until I think we were cutting like the anniversary piece a year later, and someone like spilled the beans that it had been dropped. And there was some sort of remembering, not remembering thing that I have associated with that cake. Or maybe it's just a very traumatizing memory of my wedding cake. I really don't know at this point.
You know, it's kind of funny as you try and think about these things, it's really difficult to come up with times where someone or something has demonstrated to you that your memory was false, because in our minds, we smooth all that stuff out.
Mm-hmm.
So it, and I think there's a couple different concepts that you could make distinct and separate. But I think they kind of blend together here, like the sad story about the Innocence Project and Penny Ann Bernstein. That's a really, actually a really complex story. And I recommend the listeners to go to the book called Being Wrong, pages 220 to 230 or something like that, tells her story, because she identified the wrong guy and he went to prison. And this is one of the instances. It's not just a memory, because this, her identification happened fairly, it was like the next day after her assault. But it's this common problem that we have of eyewitness accounts. And eyewitness accounts often being problematic, like this one was, and being elevated to this very high degree that there are all these other alibis. There was a lot of other reasons why he couldn't have been in this place. But the eyewitness account was believed, because when we recall a memory, especially a traumatic or a particularly emotional event, it feels as vivid and as real as when we first experienced it, or as if we did experience it, in the case of where things are false or wrong.
Well, and Brian, that stress and that trauma where it does feel so real is actually what is distorting the memory. So like when we are in a high stress situation or a traumatic situation, our memory is actually less reliable.
Absolutely.
And so like, you know, I'm thinking about LaShawn and the cake, like all of the stress around the cake and the stress of the wedding day and everything that's going on that you're managing on the day of a wedding, right? All of that is playing into how these memories, how the information is being encoded, how we're storing it, and then how we're retrieving it later. And so stress is a time, I know for me, if I'm in a situation that is very, very emotional or high stress, I really try not to say that I remember later that I remember exactly how it happened perfectly, because I know that probably I got some things wrong that I'm trying to recall, just because of the high intensity of the emotion and stress.
I see. See, that's so counterintuitive, because you would think mundane things that are insignificant, they seem more difficult to recall, and these more emotionally impressive or emotionally traumatic experiences jump right to the front of our mind. So it's counterintuitive that these feelings that feel more trustworthy, or memories, I should say, memories that feel more trustworthy are actually the ones that maybe we should rely on less.
Right.
Have either of you seen the movie Inside Out, the cartoon, recently?
Multiple times.
Okay. I saw it once.
You saw it once. So I haven't seen it. My kids and my wife just saw it today, and maybe we can. So I'm relating, you know, this is like a third person account, so you'll have to correct things. But that they were telling me about it at dinner today, and it's this, you know, it's this cartoon that's supposed to depict what your mind works in some ways. And so they have these memories that are just stored kind of like a hard drive. They're these little, are they little balls? Is that right?
They're core memories. Yes, there's five core memories that relate to these five islands of human experience. And one is family, one's play, one is like honesty, justice, integrity. Another is friendship. And the fifth one is something else that I think maybe sports or something, like the five core memories that kind of make up who you are for your personality.
Yeah, they make up this girl's identity.
Yes.
Yeah. And so they have these things kind of stored in the hard drive. But then as they get pulled out, don't they get reinterpreted, or they get recolored or retextured by the different emotions?
Yes, there is a possibility. So there's a character in there called Sadness. And so each of the emotions has an impact on memory. And the point of the movie is really learning about how sadness and joy are part of our memories, and validating sadness. Really, that's what it comes down to. Sorry to spoil this for anyone who hasn't seen it. And there's a part in the movie where sadness, the emotion, when memories are happy, they're yellow, and they match up with the happy character called Joy. Each of the emotions can touch a memory ball, and it will turn to the color of the emotion. So sadness is blue. When sadness touches a happy core yellow memory, it starts to turn blue. And so Joy basically smacks her hand away and says, "Don't touch it, don't touch it." And make it a sad memory. It needs to be happy. Just, I mean, so many layers of interpretation, and like to extrapolate out of it. It's fantastic.
Yeah, as they were telling me the basis of it, I thought this would be a you could use this to talk about all kinds of different aspects of human psychology, it sounds like.
Absolutely.
That seems to line up a little bit with what Misha was saying, that these emotions are present emotions. Whatever we're feeling at the time as we recall a memory or re-narrate a memory, they reshape and recolor our memories and therefore our identity, especially if those are our core memories, right?
Yes.
Well, let me just ask, what's the current understanding of memory? Because as I mentioned in the mini lecture, we had this idea in the 70s, and still I think carries with us today among the non-psychologist folk, of these flashbulb memories, that these emotional events will become seared into our brain, indelibly etched into our brain. And later, subsequent research has shown that that's not true. How do our memories actually form? Are they stored like a hard drive, or how does that work?
Okay, so three parts to basically long-term memory. Memory is very, very complicated. It has a lot of parts. It's very layered, but like to give like a basic like snapshot of like what is memory, it's encoding information, storing that information, and being able to retrieve that information later. So basically, there's lots of types of memory, but there's kind of three main types. Sensory memory is like our immediate interaction with a stimuli. Working memory, or short-term memory, which is more familiar to folks, is kind of the information that we get and we can only hold on to for a very short amount of time. So like the basics of short-term memory would be 7 items plus or minus 2. So 7 digits, 7 letters, 7 words, 7 whatevers, plus or minus 2. Now, working memory is normally how it's called now, and that's the ability to manipulate that information, to be able to say, here's the phone number that you just said back to me. Anything that does not get taken further is kind of just left off. We don't take it into our memory. But if it does go further, if it goes past our working memory, it becomes long-term memory. And that is where it is stored. And it can be stored in our long-term memory from after moments to our whole lifetime. And it depends on what the information is. But it absolutely can be stored in our memory for a lifetime and then be able to be retrieved. But what we also know, right, is that memory is also very colored by our context, and it's not as kind of concrete. There's more fluidity to how we retrieve and how we manipulate that information. So that's my kind of basic understanding of memory in a nutshell. This very, very, very complex system. But I don't know if LaShawn has anything to add.
No, nothing at all. That was fantastic.
The storage process is interesting to me because, as you mentioned, someone can tell me their phone number, and if they say it a couple times, I can hold on to that for a couple minutes. But back in the day, I remember one of the ward clerks claiming that he had all of the ward's phone numbers memorized in his head. And so, you know, he could call the Johnsons. Yeah. Purely for functional reasons, I'm sure. But that's something that we used to memorize a lot of phone numbers. I remember as a kid knowing, you know, all my friends' phone numbers. And now we have smartphones and, well, I guess the advent of just cell phones changed that, where we don't have to memorize all that. And I remember as going through college, listening to a lecture, you can retain a certain amount of the information that you hear. But if I took notes, that would help. If I recorded the lecture and listened to it again, that would help. So what are the different ways, or what are the different steps maybe that lock a memory in so that when it's recalled later, it has a higher degree of fidelity to, you know, the truth or the original experience?
You know, I think that that's going to depend on what your school of thought is so far as learning is concerned. Because if you look at learning styles, there's at least 5 to 8 of those. If you look at Gardner's theory of multiple intelligences, there's about 8 or 9 of those. So as educators specifically, one of the things that's new or that's emerging in education is what's called flipped learning, because we recognize how much people don't get out of reading or lecture, but there's some element of applying that if you can intersect a number of ways that encourage learning while you're teaching, it gives you more of a blanket to throw across your classroom and have them have a chance to actually engage the material, have a physical connection and interaction with it that helps them remember based on their learning style. So if you have people that are visual learners, I'm a visual learner. If I write something down, my notes are better helps to me than listening to a lecture. Although I feel like with the most random things, I have the memory of an elephant and I can recall the most needless information. It's like the triple dent gum memory in the movie that just kind of, they hold on to it because it's random and senseless. But for me as a visual learner, and for students that I have that are visual learners, that's why I make sure to buy multicolored erase markers. For my students who are more auditory learners and they learn by talking, I try and use small group discussion. For my students who are visual learners but prefer to read, I'll give a case study in class, and then I make them do small group discussion. Then I have them pick somebody that's a scribe. I give them all a different dry erase marker. And then I've at least addressed 3 different types of learning styles that hopefully in my group, my dyad or triad of people, everybody gets some sort of connection from it. Then you have kinesthetic learners, people who learn by doing. So when you have learning by doing as a person who teaches social workers, if I have them do a role play or I say, okay, what kind of intervention would you create based on the case study we've read, then that allows them to kind of learn by doing or having a role play and acting like a therapist. So as the educator, the onus and the responsibility is on me to ensure that I know learning styles and I'm willing to craft my course that can match as many learning styles as possible. I won't be able to get all of them, but at least I'm not sticking to only where I feel like I function best. Right. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And even for me, I mean, taking notes helped, but there were some courses where I had to pay so much attention that taking notes took away. Like I would miss everything. Maybe this is like a focus thing, but I would miss everything that was going on, that was being talked about as I was writing notes down. And so I guess if we're to generalize, in order to put something into our hard drive, we've got to process it multiple times, maybe multiple ways to really lock it in there. And obviously that depends on our learning style. And I think also skill. I think there are different people that maybe are just endowed with good memory skills, or there might be things that you can do to develop your capacity for memory to be much better. I think there's a study I'm just recalling off my head. I think it's called like the London Taxi Driver Study, where in order to get certified, they had to memorize a map of the city. And it's very difficult to memorize because it's very intricate, all the different details. And then they, I think it was through fMRI, they measured this area of the brain that has to do with memorizing the map. And those that passed the test had this zone, this region, I guess, was larger. And those that had been taxi drivers for a long time and had more experience, it was even yet larger. So to me, that sounds like a skill that you can develop, similar to strengthening your muscles and enlarging your muscles through exercise, weight training, or whatever. It seems like memory could be something that you could enhance through practice.
Yeah, it definitely can. And I think that the type, again, so like, it's a very complicated system. So even long-term memory, they have it, you know, divvied up into declarative memory and procedural memory. And then each of those has like several parts. So there's several parts to declarative memory. They have things that they call visual memories, autobiographical memories, mental images. Then procedural memory, there's things with motor skills, motor learning, that has to do with your cerebellum and your basal ganglia. And so you have a lot of working parts. And so if let's say that you have a deficiency in your basal ganglia, then motor learning is probably going to be difficult for you, or if you have an injury there, a lesion there. So while we can strengthen certain areas of the brain with certain exercises, it's difficult to know exactly where we're having our problem and then what to do about it to improve that part of the brain. So working memory is one of those things that folks are really trying hard to work at. So there are a lot of brain train programs now to try to increase your capacity for working memory, because working memory is one of the main problems for people with ADHD. Mm-hmm. And working memory, of course, is a part of executive functioning, which is where we kind of plan and organize our lives and how we pay attention and all of those things. Learning styles, I think, are part of it. Our brain functioning is part of it. What type of memory we're talking about. It's all like, it's pretty complicated system. But I think if you were to be able to narrow down and figure out, okay, where am I having my problem? Then you could definitely take steps to improve that area of your memory capacity.
And I have to think, similar to the pre-cell phone phase when we memorized a lot of numbers compared to now, I have to think that hundreds and then thousands of years ago, oral traditions were a lot more important and prevalent, where now we record everything. And people sat around the campfires or went in the church or whatever, and they listened to each other and they preached a lot more. And then they would pass on these stories. And I wonder if back in the day, if people as a whole had a greater skill for recalling and reciting stories than perhaps we do now.
That's like interesting, because they're doing it. They're doing it so often, and that's the way to transport the information. So I think that makes total sense.
Well, and I think it contributes to why we have as much, dissonance today, and where we have to really clarify what have we been taught, in addition to what are the facts of what actually happened. I think of people who, want to just go back to the good old days when everything was fine and we didn't have all of the strife and stress in our country, in America, as an example. And it depends on who you ask about what the good old days were and what they mean by the good old days. Because for some people, if you say, we could go back to the 50s and the 40s where, and then generally some of the most stereotypical things will start to come out of their mouths. They'll say, when men were real men, or when women knew their place, or any other such thing that just shows you how they're remembering what the good old days were is sometimes problematic. Yeah. And there are times where I was teaching my class, I teach a course in African American culture, and I was talking with them about the 50s and the 60s, and I was talking with them about the intersections of different social movements in American history, and how it seems that when we think of the good old days, we're often thinking about entertainment too. And in the 50s and 60s, when you began to see more integrated musicians and Motown took off, and then you had rock and you had R&B and you had these different things that started emerging, music was a really cool connecting force in American society. And even in the 20s and 30s during the Harlem Renaissance, that also brought people together in those fun memories of social connection and social unity that were experienced in small pockets of our country. I tell my students, I think that feeling is what people are remembering that felt good to them in those moments. And it's completely divorced from the structural and systemic oppression, discrimination, and violence that was also happening simultaneously in our society. And people have a very hard time making space to hold both. Right. It has to either be all good or either be all bad, because if it's both, well, then what does that mean? How does that have moral value or any moral fortitude for my ability to assert this is what goodness is presently in my life, so I can teach my kids to be good or to be fill in the blank based on how I remember it because of how I experienced it?
Yeah, I think that's the limitation. I do speculate that they were better at recalling and retelling stories than we are now, because we don't do that. But it's still highly limited, right? In the way that you're describing, those stories get edited, perhaps subconsciously, in order to emphasize certain aspects.
Cherry pick.
Yeah, exactly. And so as long as we're going back in time, and now we'll get to the Mormon section of the podcast, let's talk about some history. History as it's done now is generally written from documents that were preserved. But often those documents that might have been written in 1859, for instance, or 1852, are talking about something that happened a decade or more earlier. And so it's not the same thing as us finishing this podcast and I go write in my journal about how what a great experience it was right away. It would be like me looking back 10 years from now and talking about my podcasting days or something like that, right? The topic that comes up all the time is the first vision. It's problematic, but I tend to think, after been reading about memory, I tend to think that it's less problematic than the way it's often discussed. Because the event supposedly happened around 1820, but even that is a little bit fuzzy. According to the documents, it was first retold, or at least written down, in 1832, so 12 years later. And then there's there's an 1835 version, but we also have the 1838 version that got canonized, and there's an 1842 version. My understanding is there's other ones as well, but these are the main ones that come up, that where Joseph was either writing it himself or he was dictating to someone for it to be written down. And we see things change over time. The way that it's often discussed is that these changes were deliberate, and that he was manipulating his story to make the past experience match up with his current theology. For instance, in the 1832 version, he refers to seeing the Lord. And then in the 1838 version, he sees God the Father and his Son, Jesus Christ. And so it's things like this and some of the other aspects. The first one, he was just forgiven of his sins. And then later it was that he wrestled with the devil. And then I'm just going off my memory here. This is dangerous. and then he was told that to join no church. That was the question that he put towards God, and that he had to start his own, that he was commissioned by God to start his own. And after studying memory, I am less inclined to think that these changes were deliberate. Because for one thing, when journals of early converts of the church, early members of the church, they don't talk about the first vision event. They talk about other things like spiritual gifts and the Book of Mormon and that kind of stuff. And so this wasn't something that was rehearsed in his mind, or at least according to the documents that we have, it wasn't something that was rehearsed all the time. And so, we also don't know if he went back and actually looked at the first time he wrote it down, compared it, and then strategically made these changes, or as he translated the Book of Mormon, and then translated or just edited the Bible, learned some Hebrew, learned about Elohim, meaning being a plural, the name of God, Elohim, denoting plural or multiple gods, translating the Book of Abraham, translating in air quotes, of course. But he goes through all this change where his theology does change, his understanding in his mind of God and what his mission is as a prophet has changed over time. To me, it makes more sense that these changes in the retelling of the first vision came about, I guess I would say innocently, that they came about by his beliefs about his mission, his beliefs about God changing inside his mind, and therefore affecting the way that he told this story from his youth.
So I think before we either absolve or convict, we just talk about what are the elements that are at play. So what we have is what we know today about memory. It's not overall, not super reliable, very colored by our context, informed by our context, and impacted by our emotions. We also know that high stress situations can impact the reliability of our memories, what's going on emotionally, the stress of a situation, the trauma of a situation. And, you know, if people were to say, well, you know, how can you forget if you saw God or not? Or how can you forget who you saw in your vision? Remember, right? People forgot big events, right? I forgot where they said, you'll never forget what happened on 9/11. I forgot. I fabricated a reality for myself that just wasn't, that couldn't be true. So I think those are the elements that we want to keep in our memory as we're discussing it, because I think that those are all important things based on, you know, with everything in mind. So,
right. That's what I was thinking as I was kind of trying to summarize the facts about the discrepancies between the different visions. And it kind of led me to think that I think he did have some profound experience, whether it was inside his mind, as Steve Peck tends to think that our consciousness is the vehicle for revelation, or whether it was a real visitation by some divine entity. It seems like, to me, he had some sort of experience that was important to him, that, you know, made him feel like he was a good person, made him feel like he had a special mission or something like that. But it seems that, as you said, since memory's not very reliable, we can't use those accounts to say this is what happened exactly or this is what did not happen. To me, it seems like they're,
this person is a liar.
Right. Like exactly.
You don't want to say this person's just a flat out liar. No, there's more to it than that. Right. And I think that we have this binary, either it happened exactly this way or liar. And it's just much more complicated than that, which I think is what we're trying to tease apart a little, for sure.
Well, and I think that it's as complicated as we say that it is. And I also think that it can be as simple as we're supposed to believe that it is. Like, either we believe in further light and knowledge, or we struggle to believe in further light and knowledge. Like, I'm not as familiar with how people and leaders of other religions are followed or worshipped as it may be, but I think if we are looking at Joseph as either hero or human, we've really got to make a decision. Either he's a hero that's completely infallible, or he's human and he grew. Why would we not want to see a prophet grow in his knowledge and understanding of the gospel? Maybe he didn't go back and say, you know, I was wrong about this, or I was young and so I understood it this way, and now that I'm older, I understand it that way. I often wonder what folks are looking to have as their okay, I'm okay with it moment. I think about Buddhism, and I think about how many people follow the Buddha, but it's really not about following the Buddha. It's following what the Buddha teaches you to be about yourself and your own mindfulness and your own experience. And I wonder if folks of the LDS faith can find a way to do the same thing. instead of relying and having your testimony built on one man, maybe look at what that man's purpose was and see how that purpose has better informed and influenced your life. Does that make sense?
I think that sounds like a very difficult request, LaShawn.
I think it sounds like a sensible request, but
it
probably is difficult because the cut and dry version, it's either all false or it's all true. That kind of question or rhetoric is really powerful. It forces someone to make a decision and say, well, I believe it. You know, I've had a good experience in church, and so it must be true. Rather than using his experience and his story as a guide or a rough template for your own journey in accessing the divine and in becoming a larger person.
Way too much agency. Way too much. Yeah. We just can't have that much agency, can we?
Yeah, agency's hard on us.
It is. And I think that that's one thing. I mean, I'm going to give a presentation on Thursday at the university down in Provo, at BYU, talking about being faithful at the intersection where it comes to race and gender identity development within the church. And I came to a part in my presentation where I talk about the fact that conversation and discussion about plans and moving forward, it had to happen. Like, we believe that there was a grand council in the heavens, not that a grand memo was sent out and we all agreed to it. Like, a grand council, we had to hear presentations. We know that there were at least two that we heard. We know that one of them was actually, on my bad days, Satan had a great idea. You know what? Because if I could get you to behave right and just do what you're supposed to do, my life would be so much easier. So I can get that. But we don't really take the time to say, we had a conversation. We probably asked some questions. And we said, okay, this grand council, what are we all going to do so that we can get back here together? Satan, I see where your plan is coming from. There are days here in this earthly existence where I'm like, you know what? The dude had a good idea. If I could just get these folks to behave, things would be fine. But we, at some point, discussed and then decided that there was going to be a better route for all of us to be able to use our agency. But it's like we're so scared to realize that we have a voice and that we have the right to question and to discuss and to say, well, do I understand this differently now because I'm older? Or is it really the same thing that I thought it was when I was 3? And I guess maybe that is really, really hard to do, but I feel like, you know, gifts of the Spirit, some of it, we have to figure out what our gifts are so that as the body of Christ, we're able to use our gifts to keep the whole body healthy. And maybe we're not doing that if we can't revisit our process of remembering.
Amen.
Amen. I think this topic is actually a way that we can approach that. I mean, I think this is kind of a nice mixing of science and theology, or science and personal development, because it study and memory, we learn that things that we feel so right or feel so correct and in accordance with reality, learning that that's just because it feels that way doesn't mean that it is, and it could be flat out wrong. That's humbling.
Right.
And that teaches us to humble ourselves, but also to give some slack to our brothers and sisters around us, because we all know that we've gone off on something that we felt very confident about at one point, and maybe we didn't really have the basis to be confident about it, but it's because we felt so strongly about it, we went forward, and we probably stepped on some people's toes. You know, we've all done things like that, and we see other people doing things like that to us. But I think this is an opportunity to learn humility and grant others grace. And, you know, there was that quote from General Conference. Was it Elder Anderson that said, give Joseph Smith a break? I think this might be one instance where we can say, yeah, we'll give him a break on that one. There's some other things that maybe we don't have to give him a break on. But this is, we can admit, like you say, that he is human, that there's things that are undeniable. He did form a new church. He inspired thousands of people to follow him. He was incredibly creative, good or bad, however you take that. He was a religious innovator, that sort of thing. But that's who he was. He wasn't this perfect, shining, perfect prophet guy. He made tons of mistakes, some of them more troubling than others.
And he was also limited in his humanness, right? his capacity was limited. And I think that we forget sometimes when we call someone a prophet, you know, it's like Sean was saying, you know, you're a prophet, now you're not human. That's just not true. Like, you still have the brain and the body and the functioning of a human. Now, you may have clarity of thought, you may have inspiration, you may have guidance by the Holy Spirit, but that does not mean that you are still not limited by the fact that your brain has this much capacity for this particular thing. And so granting him complexity through his humanity, I think, is very important, and what I think most of us want and are asking for.
Yeah, and I think granting the complexity and humanness and all this, it allows us to not only forgive, but it allows us to critique as well. We don't. It's not just a one way street. It gives us that room to say, maybe that wasn't quite right. Maybe this was a bad idea. Right. It gives us that latitude in him, in ourselves, and in those that we go to church with.
Yep,
absolutely.
All right. Before we wrap up, do you have any other closing thoughts on memory or anything else that we've touched on during this conversation?
I think all I would say is that to understand the importance of meaning making, I know for myself and probably for Misha as well, as therapists, we are concerned with how people make meaning of what they've experienced. And that has a lot to do with the memories that they hold on to. And a particular therapeutic piece or intervention is called narrative therapy. And it's about rewriting your story because of who you are now and here and now and how you interpret or reinterpret what happened there and then. And so I guess in that sense, memory isn't anything to be scared of, but it's kind of freeing to know that memory doesn't have to be this prison of pain. That if you can make meaning out of it, understand what purpose it served for you, whether it was a protective purpose or some kind of encouraging or empowering purpose, you get to be the master of that for yourself as you move into your own healthy definition of self, emotional, psychological congruence, spiritual congruence, whatever that might mean for you, and to be able to usher and support people in meaning making when it comes to some of the complexities in the LDS church, I think is going to be really helpful if we're able to embrace that.
Beautiful. That's great. Misha, do you have any final thoughts on the topic?
No, I love that LaShawn brought up meaning making, and I just second everything that she said, because that's huge. We have a lot more ability to and power in our own lives. And I think sometimes we feel that we are trapped by our past, and really from a Newtonian perspective, which I try to be non-Newtonian, but I have a hard time with it. But from a Newtonian perspective, like, the past isn't real. It doesn't exist. All that we have are memories of it. And just knowing that there's a lot more fluidity and flexibility to those memories, I think is important. So when you have folks growing up in the same house and have very different experiences of that house and very different memories of what things happened in that home or wherever, those can both be valid and true and real for each person individually. So just again, I think being gracious with ourselves and being gracious with other people is so important when it comes to how we retrieve information and recall it and use it either for good or for not so good. So,
excellent. All right. Well, thank you both, Misha and LaShawn, for coming on the podcast again to impart your wisdom to all of us.
I guess I'll say you're welcome. Thanks for having us.
Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed that show. I hope it was informative and entertaining, as usual. I'll leave one last reminder to go to the Indiegogo page. You can find a link on this very blog post. Also, if you just look at rationalfaith.com on a personal computer, on the right side of the page, there's a couple banners. One of them is the Liahona Children's Foundation logo. Click on that, and it'll take you right to our Indiegogo page where you can donate and you can select a perk that you can receive for your donation. So please do that, and please comment and let me know how the podcast is doing. For me personally, I really enjoy hearing that people like it, that they get some sort of benefit out of it, that it at very least entertains them, maybe informs them, maybe helps them see things differently. And I would also like to know where maybe you think I've gotten things wrong as I ramble on and create this material. Also, as for next week, I'll be putting out an episode that I recorded with Benjamin Knoll, where we talked with a religious studies professor about new religious movements and the way that we look at new religious movements and religion in general differently than the way that we look at the rest of our lives. And so look forward to that one. And until next time, keep keeping it weird.